that question. The question that she asked was, I gave you a source, Gemara, which says that b'makom tzar lo gazru rabbanan, that rabbinic decrees were not created for cases in which people are in pain, which seems to imply that, in general, anytime we're dealing with pain in any of our hierarchy of cases, drabbanans won't apply. But then we saw the Rambam say that if somebody is in pain, you're allowed to ask a non-Jew to do a derabbanan because it is shvus de shvus. It's a double rabbinic prohibition, meaning the whole act of asking a non-Jew to do malacha for you on Shabbos is itself rabbinic, and what you're asking the non-Jew to do is only rabbinically prohibited, and therefore it's allowed. So the good question which Allah asked was, why do I even need the Rambam to tell me that? Once you're already talking about a rabbinic prohibition, then it should be okay because the person is in pain. Right? Everyone understands the question? Right? Clear cut? I mean, it's the right question to ask. So the answer to the question is, and this is an idea that Rav Yoel Amital develops in an article in the journal Hamayan, which I think is from Shalvim, from a few years back. But it's a relatively straightforward answer once you recognize it. Is the Rishonim, right? We're talking Ramban, Rashba, Magen Mishnah on the Rambam, all make a statement along the lines of Ein Medamin Shavusin. What that means is you can't compare one Darabanan to another. If you find a case in the Gemara in which a rabbinic prohibition is overridden for the sake of somebody who is in pain, that doesn't necessarily mean that all rabbinic prohibitions will be overridden because somebody is in pain. Not all rabbinic prohibitions are created equal, is effectively their statement. Some of them can be overridden, some of them cannot be overridden, and it's not always clear which ones you can override. And it may depend on the value for which you are overriding the derabbanan, meaning sometimes it's to enable a particular mitzvah. Example, we have a Gemara which talks about being able to override a derabbanan to bring hot water for the sake of a kid who's going to have a bris milah, because the Gemara understood that you need to wash the child after the bris. There's a risk of harm if you don't. Maybe they're referring to infection. Unclear. The Gemara doesn't use that kind of language. But the Gemara says you need to be able to wash the kid with warm water after the bris. If you don't have warm water, you're not going to do the bris on Shabbos. So they bring the water, overriding a derabbanan in order to get the water there, because the mitzvah of bris milah is really, really important. We would not necessarily override a derabbanan for a different mitzvah. You follow what I'm trying to say? Not all derabbanans are created equal. That's something that we've already noted. And not all reasons to override are created equal either. And so because of that, because it's not as though all of these are equal, therefore, in principle, even though the Gemara sounds like it's saying a flat rule, in a case of pain, the rabbi's decrees don't apply, the answer is, maybe. It depends on which pain, and it depends on which decrees. As opposed to the rule that we read last time from the Rambam, which is, in the event that that it's a shvus de shvus, it's a double derabanan, then it will be 100% permitted, and then will be and that'll apply to all derabanans. Yeah, Ariane.
I'm confused when it's going to be a double derabanan. What is that? I'm like a little bit confused about that.
Yeah. So again, a double derabanan means that it's rabbinically prohibited. Well, in the case at hand, it means it's rabbinically prohibited for me to ask a non-Jew to do malacha. And the malacha that I'm asking the non-Jew to do is itself only rabbinically prohibited. That's what makes it a double derabanan, right? It's rabbinically prohibited on two levels. If you were allowed to ask non-Jews to do this, to do malacha, then that would be entirely permitted. If this malacha had not been prohibited by the rabbis, it would be entirely permitted.
Can I get an example?
That is an example.
Like you're saying, if I ask a Jew to, get me medicine, that's, the first derabanan, and then,
asking a Jew?
No, non-Jew.
A non-Jew, correct.
And that's the first derabanan, and the second...
And the second aspect of it is that what I'm asking him to do is fundamentally only rabbinically prohibited, to carry it through an area without an Eruv. right? If I were asking a non-Jew to, let's say, write me a prescription, that's a biblical prohibition, writing on Shabbos. So then I'm only doing, it's only one derabbanan, it's one layer of derabbanan. Double is where what I'm asking them to do is itself only rabbinically prohibited. Got it? Is that a little more clear? Okay. So that's just answering the question from last time. So where we left off was this issue of asking a non-Jew to do things for you on Shabbos, and we were talking about why it's not allowed. First of all, we said that in general, malacha done on Shabbos, the product of malacha done on Shabbos, is off limits. Right? That was what we called Maaseh Shabbos. That rings a bell. And separate from that, we said, I'm not allowed to tell a non-Jew to do things for me on Shabbos. We saw one reason for that last time, because the Torah says, Kol malacha lo ye'aseh bahem. Malacha shall not be done. Not just you don't do malacha, but malacha shall not be done. That makes it sound almost like this is a biblical prohibition, but we generally do not treat it as that, as biblical. And then we started to bring two, well, ultimately three, other explanations for how we know what the source is for this prohibition. So if I were to ask you, what is the source for this prohibition, I'd be looking not for an explanation of what the prohibition is, but for the source you brought last time or one of the three that I'm going to bring, you know, now. Clear? Okay? So our first source? Our first source is the pasuk that says, Kol malacha lo ye'aseh. Malacha shall not be done. I realize no one can see the nekudot that I just put under that, but, you know, it makes me feel better. The malacha shall not be done, as opposed to kol malacha lo ta'aseh, you shall not do malacha. If you shall not do, then it's just me. Ye'aseh, it shall not be done. That's a first explanation. The second one, which we had started on last time, is Rashi in a Gemara in Shabbos. The Gemara in Shabbos is talking about somebody who finds themselves carrying their wallet when Shabbos starts. So what do they want to do? They want to hand it to a non-Jew who's going to take it to their house for them. That's our situation. And the Gemara then asks, why would you be allowed to give it to a non-Jew? Why should I be allowed to do that? And Rashi explains why the Gemara is surprised by this permission. Take a look at source number one on your sheet, where the Gemara says, My time ashari le lemesav lenachri. Why are you allowed to give it to a non-Jew? And Rashi explains, Vaharehu shlucha lisa enu b'shabbos. Isn't he the non-Jew, then your agent to carry it on Shabbos? The reason why the Gemara is surprised that you can give it to a non-Jew, and then the Gemara goes off and deals with the problem. We're not dealing with that right now. But the Gemara's challenge is because, hey, the non-Jew is your shaliach. The non-Jew becomes your agent. And that's another reason why you shouldn't be allowed to have a non-Jew do it on Shabbos. It's really like you're doing it. When you ask them to do it, it's like you did the malacha. The non-Jew is your shaliach, your agent, your proxy. You follow that? Clear? Yeah, yeah.
The only way that if you're holding your wallet, the only way that the non-Jew will take it is if they see that you have your wallet instead of you saying, can you take my wallet and bring it to your house?
That would be a way. Alternatively, if, let's say, you see them riding a bicycle and you just stick it on the back of the bicycle without them knowing, because then they don't know, right?
So they can't know that they're... Okay.
Yeah, that's the theory. Yeah.
The two sources on the board, those are sources for why you can't give him...
Why you can't instruct... Why you're not allowed to instruct him to do malacha for you. The first one was not stated about wallets or anything. It was just a general statement. The second one is a comment Rashi makes in the wallet case, but it would apply anytime you ask the non-Jew. But this isn't about wallets. This is about asking a non-Jew to do something for you on Shabbos. Bless you. The third explanation also comes from Rashi, and this is very, very important. It's one that a lot of people are not familiar with, but it is a halacha. It's called Vidaber Davar. Anybody know where Vidaber Davar comes from?
Is it like
Sorry?
Yeshayahu.
How did you know that? There you go. It is a pasuk in Yeshayahu. As a matter of fact, it was the Haftarah on the morning of Yom Kippur. The end of the Haftarah, Yeshaya talks about observance of Shabbos. It's a big deal. So he says that on Shabbos, mimitzoch eftzecha, you're not supposed to pursue your personal business, whatever it is that you've been pursuing during the week, v'daber davar, and you should not speak of matters. You're not supposed to speak about weekday matters on Shabbos. So what that includes, people are not necessarily aware of it, and it's something to be aware of, is that I am not supposed to talk about malacha on Shabbos using the language of malacha, meaning I'm not supposed to talk about driving on Shabbos. I'm not supposed to talk about writing on Shabbos. Obviously, there are contexts where it's okay to do so. So for example, I'm learning Torah and the topic of writing comes up, that's 100% fine. But I shouldn't say to somebody that, you know, I wrote you a letter or I'm planning on writing you a letter. We're not supposed to speak of malacha on Shabbos. That's the idea. This is a derabanan. Yeah?
So, like, if someone's telling a story, that, like, let's say about something that happened to them in driver's ed, they shouldn't tell it on Shabbos?
Well, they can find a way to do it without using the verbs. That would be ideal.
So, like, you couldn't say, I was driving in driver's ed. You could just say,
I was going. I was in driver's ed.
Okay.
Yeah. It's about being careful with your language, because Yeshaya is trying to get us to create a Shabbos atmosphere in which we discard the weekday stuff. That's the idea, too.
But isn't it kind of about intention also?
Meaning?
Like, technically, you could put the TV on on Shabbos, and then you could watch TV on Shabbos, but, like, that's not in the spirit, and just, like, talking about driver's ed is not.
So that goes back to what is potentially a biblical consideration, right? We had a shiur before Yontif, where we talked about Shabbaton, how the Torah talks about and presents this mitzvah of Shabbaton, and Ramban explains that I have an obligation to create an atmosphere of rest on Shabbos, where actions that, as you're noting, could be permitted, you know, moving stuff around in my house, moving furniture, could be permitted, but if I do that, I'm never going to have a Shabbos experience. So that's, you know, what you're talking about by leaving the TV on, and that is a consideration, and yes, this is part of that same concern, but Yeshaya gives it a specific application and says, don't talk about the kinds of things that are weekday things as opposed to Shabbos things. That's the concern. If you're wondering, this sounds a little bit vague, the answer is it is vague. And it's up to individuals to implement it, to understand what exactly the issue is and how to implement it. You know, it requires some sensitivity. I saw a hand somewhere in the middle.
You answered.
Okay. So this is the idea called Vidaber Davar. So take a look at Rashi in source number 2. Rashi writes, Al Hashabbos lo nitztavu b'nei noach. He says, non-Jews have no mitzvah of observing Shabbos. Right? There's no mitzvah for a non-Jew to observe Shabbos, just the opposite. They're not supposed to take on observing Shabbos. Umasha asur li Yisrael lomar lo'ove kochavim asei li kach. The fact that a Jew is not allowed to say to a non-Jew, do such and such for me on Shabbos. Why not? Zeu mishum mimitzel cheftzecha v'daber davar. That's because of this pasuk in Yeshaya, that you're not supposed to pursue your needs, you're not supposed to speak of matters, meaning weekday matters. Dibur aser, that speech is prohibited. And therefore, I'm not allowed to tell a non-Jew to light a fire for me. I'm not allowed to tell a non-Jew to drive this item home for me. Yeah, Ariana.
So usually on Shabbos, that's like when families eat like Friday night dinner, like they are all together. So would you be able to, like, this doesn't have anything to do with of like not bringing weekday into Shabbos? Would you be able to like tell everyone about like your day or like your week, something that happened to during the week?
So this is a really good question. My understanding is that it could be done, as long as it's done with sensitivity to Shabbos. So there's a difference between me saying the highlight of my week this past week was that I went to a hockey game, right? That would be okay. For me to start making the conversation at the Shabbos table about the game and retelling what happened and this player is great and this player is terrible and they should fire the coach, like that gets a little much. I think that there's a line and it's not a clear line. It's much more about sensitivity. Abby?
If we're saying how Rashi was saying like not to talk about and telling it to a non-Jew, but we were saying before that you could say, like, I was going instead of I was driving. Would that apply to me?
Yes. that absolutely would apply to this. When we talk about the ways to deal with Amir al-Aqlam, one of the ways to deal with it, make sure you hear this, because it's important. We're going to come back to it, but still, hearing it now is good, is to make sure that when you talk to the non-Jew, you don't mention the malacha. So there's a difference between saying, it's dark in here, and saying, please turn on the light. So yes, that distinction matters. Julie?
That was my question.
There you go. I find that very often, that people ask similar questions. It's a good thing. We're thinking along the same lines. But now I have a problem. Why did Rashi give me this answer when before he gave the other answer? He said it was because of being a shaliach, being an agent.
He was giving the Gemara's
answer. Not necessarily. It's a good thought. The Kilas Yaakov, also known as the Stipler, gives the following answer. He says both of these are true. They apply in different cases. If I tell the non-Jew on Friday to carry my wallet, then I said it on Friday. There's nothing wrong with Vidaber Davar on Fridays. I can say whatever I want on Fridays in terms of naming malachos. There is no rule in Judaism that says on Fridays you shall not talk about driving or writing or carrying or whatever it is. You did not violate Vidaber Davar by telling him to do it on Friday. However, by telling him to do it on Shabbos, you're saying to him on Friday, do this for me on Shabbos. He is your agent. If you are concerned about him being your agent, you still have a problem. You follow?
So if you're saying, like, on Friday, you see a non-Jew, you're saying, if I have my wallet on Shabbos, can you just take it from me?
I'm going to have my wallet on Shabbos. Let's get, why if?
I'm going to have my wallet on Shabbos, can you take it from me?
Yeah.
Take that on Friday?
So that would be a problem if I believe that making him my agent is an issue. On the other hand, if on Shabbos I ask the non-Jew to do something for me, and I make sure not to use those verbs, right, like Abby had asked, right, I just say it's dark in here. But it's obvious that I'm telling him, you know, I say to him, I don't say to him, turn on the light. I have a code with my non-Jewish neighbor. My code with the non-Jewish neighbor is I say to him, I don't know, can you pick up the shade? Something that's mutter, right, on Shabbos. And he knows that means turn on the light. So I haven't used any of the verbs, but I did make him my agent. Right? So both of these are potential concerns. If I speak to him on Friday, I'm sorry, that wasn't the other case. One second, sorry, Danielle. The other case wasn't that. The other case where it would be an issue is the case where I talked to him on Shabbos about doing something for me after Shabbos. So there's nothing wrong with making him my agent to do something after Shabbos. That's fine. However, if I use the language, then I do have a problem. Then I have a Vidaber Davar issue. So I need to watch out for that. Yes, Danielle.
What's Rashi?
It should say medical treatment on Shabbat number 10. Right, does everyone have it? It was source number 3. Source number 2. Sorry. I take
that's
that back.
Not the Rashi?
That is the Rashi, no?
No, it's the Rama the Stipler.
Oh, the Stipler. I'm sorry. The Stipler was not in a source on the sheet. No, I understand. Yeah, no, I didn't bring the Stipler on the sheet. The Stipler is not cut and pastable. So that tends to be, although now the Microsoft Word has dictate options, so I do that sometimes, but if I can't cut and paste it, it's a pain to retype it. I'm already translating it. Yeah.
What you just said, and then you're like, no, it's not the right example. Why doesn't that? Why
is
that true?
Oh, no, it is true. It's just not an example of where the language is an issue and being a shaliach is not an issue.
Oh, fine. It's another example of when shaliach is an issue and whatever.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. So those are my second and third issues. Making the non-Jew my agent and Vidaber Davar as well, the issue of using that language. There's one last issue, which is much broader. And more vague. We like vague. And this is something that the Rambam is going to mention for us, and that will be in source number 3. And the issue is basically taking Shabbos seriously. I'm going to write seriously on the board as my summary of that. Take a look at number 3, please. The Rambam writes in Hilchos Shabbos, V'davar zeh asur midivrei sofrim. You're not allowed to tell a non-Jew to do malacha for you on Shabbos. This is rabbinically prohibited. Kidei shalotiyah Shabbos kala be'einehen v'yavo lasos bi'atzman. Because otherwise Shabbos will be lenient in their eyes and they might come to do the malacha themselves. Meaning Jews might come to do it themselves. it is unclear to me whether the Rambam is saying that Shabbos will be light in our eyes or in the non-Jews' eyes, because it could also make it light in the non-Jews' eyes. Like the non-Jew says to himself, sure, these Jews have these rules. The rules say that they're not allowed to turn on the light, but they can ask me to turn on the light. What kind of joke is that, right? For the non-Jew, this is like, you're totally violating the spirit of your day. Why, you know, you don't take this seriously. So maybe that's a concern, but also the main concern is clearly that Jews are going to come to do this themselves. Yeah.
For your first example, it might become like light in a non-Jew's eyes, but like that kind of happens anyway. Like, because like we have an Arab. Like I saw someone like posted a video on like social media. Like a not Jewish person posted like, do you ever wonder why there's a string around Manhattan? Oh, it's an Arab. And all the comments were like, oh, they're like making loopholes around the law. It's not a real religion. Like we're still making it light in their eyes by doing other things.
Yeah, but to the extent that we can minimize that, we should. I mean, it's true. It's a fundamental challenge. And it's a challenge not just in terms of the eyes of the world, but in terms of our own eyes. Right? It's an issue for us.
I feel like in our own eyes that also happens, where it's like,
yeah.
Oh, I could carry, there's an Arab, and you don't think that carrying is really important.
Right. No, it's true. It's not just an issue of the way it appears to them. It's an issue of how we view it, and it's true. And sometimes you will see that there's a rabbinic decree specifically in areas that people take lightly because of things like this in order to make it more serious. I'll give you an example. And I see your hand, Shira. I want to address this point because it's a very interesting one. What's the rule of Maris Ayin?
So I was trying to think that when good is a meat,
yeah.
That you shouldn't do things that like can cause people to judge you and be
rude. Right. Don't do things that look like a violation of halacha. Two different reasons not to do it. One reason not to do it is people might think, well, I know that person, they're careful. If they're doing that, it must be okay, right? Or at least desensitizes them to the prohibition. Or alternatively, because as Ricky said, they're going to suspect that you're doing something wrong. That's the basic principle. Should we be more serious about that regarding Maris Ayin for De'oraisas or for De'rabanans? Yeah.
I would say like Derabanan.
Yeah.
Since like Derabanan, there's like more leniency and like there are ways to go around it, and people might think like, oh, that's a lenient. Versus like if something's Derabanan, then it's like.
Exactly. Exactly. You could have argued Maris Ayin is, you know, a concern really when you're talking about De'oraisa issues, because that's really where we're, you know, those are of greater significance. But the other argument is no, people are more apt to take a derabanan lightly, and therefore there are views in the Rishonim who actually say we're more careful about Maris Ayin on a derabanan. Example, you've definitely, you know, thought about this at some point in the context of Maris Ayin. What if there's something you're not allowed to do because of Maris Ayin? However, I'm going to do it in private where nobody can see me. And therefore, there's no Maris Ayin consideration. Example, the rule is that if my clothing is soaking wet, I'm not supposed to hang it up on Shabbos in an area where I normally hang laundry. Because someone might think that you did laundry on Shabbos. How many people are walking into my house to see, you know, in the old days where you had a one-room house and anybody could see in your window, maybe, you know, or people just naturally walked in and out of people's houses, a neighbor maybe getting to their house upstairs or whatever it was, you know, that would be a consideration. Today, if I'm going to hang stuff in my laundry room in my basement, the world isn't going to be aware of it. So maybe this is no longer a consideration. However, we have a rule, Maris Ayin applies even bechadrei chadarim, even in rooms inside of rooms. Flat rule. The question is, does that apply to deoraisas, to derabanans, to both? So there's an argument that says it only applies to derabanans because that's the one that we really worried about more, as opposed to deoraisas, people already take them seriously. That's the idea. Now, Shira was waiting with a question, but Danielle, was your question about Maris Ayin, or was it from before?
Oh, it was a question.
Oh.
I'm just like,
right, so then you get to the issues of chinuch for children around. Those are also, yeah, that is also a valid concern for sure. Shira, what were you going to say?
My family doesn't do this, but I know other people, like, they would invite, like, someone who's not keeping Shabbos or someone who's not Jewish into their homes, but this be, like, one of the reasons so that they don't accidentally do all that, like, you know?
That's interesting. Maybe. Maybe. I don't know.
Because, like, why are all these people having non-Jews?
What do you mean?
Like, these are all, like, examples that you can just easily find a non-Jewish person. Like, people that live in, like, fully formed communities, like, are not... I can't just go outside and be like, hey, I'm a non-Jew.
Like, New Square, there's no fully formed community.
You're asking about... I'm not sure I understand the question, but you're asking how do people find a person to turn on the light for them on Shabbos?
It just seems like it'd be easier if there was non-Jewish people to ask about any of this and then you wouldn't have to worry about it.
That's an interesting issue. I mean, Maris Zion, you're not dealing with. You're talking about
before we talked about that.
So you're saying if Jews lived in areas where they were all Jewish, then Amir La'akum wouldn't be a problem.
Exactly.
That's interesting. It's an interesting take. The Gemara does have a preference for Jews living among other Jews, but not for that reason, more out of concern that you get influenced by the behavior of your neighbors. You see things, and that becomes the norm, which is a great discussion for another time. But I don't know about that as the explanation in order to avoid Amir La'akum problems. In any case, coming back towards our topic, we have four different reasons that are brought for why one should not speak to a non-Jew on Shabbos telling them to do something on your behalf. We're now going to see mitigation, ways that make this better, so that Amir La'akum is actually going to be allowed. But before that, I want to stress something. I said it already last time, but I want to make sure that it's clear, which is when we say that in certain medical circumstances, you're allowed to tell a non-Jew to do something that is biblically prohibited or rabbinically prohibited, right? We said, for chola she'ein bo sakana, you're allowed to have the non-Jew do something that's biblically prohibited. We said, for the mikzas choli, you're allowed to tell the non-Jew to do something that is rabbinically prohibited. That means you don't need a workaround. You are able to just tell them. You can use the verbs, you can, like, that's justified in that circumstance. However, it's important to know the mitigations, because remember what we said. Shabbos is dechuya, not putra, right? Going back to the beginning of the year. We said that Shabbos is pushed off, but if you're able to minimize the violation of Shabbos, you should do so. So there are strategies that we have to mitigate Amir La'akum. Got it? That's what we're going to talk about now, with strategies to make it less of a concern. Yeah.
Right. I just thought of something. So if this is if we're supposed to mitigate it, then why do we call Hatzalah? Why don't we call 911?
Generally, because Hatzalah has a much better track record than 911.
Oh.
Yeah, Hatzalah tends to get there faster than 911, simply because 911 is dealing with a much larger catchment of people who are calling them.
You have to
do whatever is going to be medically most effective. And if 911 where you live is more effective, then you call 911. Yeah. There is discussion about saying on Shabbos, if somebody's life is in danger, you should specifically get a Jew as opposed to a non-Jew. There is such a thing. We talked about it very briefly in the beginning of the year. But it's more of a concern where you have Jews and non-Jews available and it looks like you're trying to avoid calling a Jew. Looks like you're trying to avoid that, and the result may be that in the future, when they don't have a non-Jew available, they're not going to violate Shabbos because they say, oh, see, we look to ask a non-Jew. But if you know that 911 is going to be faster and more effective, then that's what you do, 100%. Okay. So the following does not help with Amir La'akum. Gesturing as opposed to speaking, right? I'm just going to point. I'm avoiding the verbs, but it doesn't get you out of Amir La'akum fundamentally. We have more concern than just the verbs. If you take a look at source number 4, here I did use Microsoft Word's dictate option. Aser lirmoz lo b'shabbos u'b'yom tov b'lashon tzivui she'ya'asena. One may not hint to the non-Jew on Shabbos or Yom Tov with language of expression, and then it says, Bein sha'remez hu'ayidei dibur, language of instruction. Then it says, Bein sha'remez hu'ayidei dibur, bein shu'ayidei tnuos, whether you're speaking or whether you're gesturing, pointing at the light switch is not okay. Yes, it's true. You didn't use the verbs. You checked off that box. But the other concerns still apply. So, you know, pointing doesn't do anything. Also, hinting, which is blatant, which is obvious, does not work. If you take a look at source number 5, Mishneh Berurah, V'hu adin she'asur lomar lo b'shabbos ezeh davar she'yavin mitoch kach she'yaseh melacha. You can't tell him something on Shabbos such that he's now going to understand, oh, you want me to do malacha, even though you hinted. So you can't say to him to wipe his nose so that he'll understand, you know, the lamps develop charcoal on a wick if it's burning for a long time. And it starts to dim the light, or it makes the light, you know, burn less, the oil burn less well. So you want to communicate him to wipe off the wick, which you can't do on Shabbos. So you gesture, you know, you should wipe your nose, and he knows what you mean is wipe the wick. It's your code, like what I said before about the shade. So that's not okay. And even saying there's no light in the room can potentially be a problem. If you look at source number 6, Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa says, and then I'll take questions, Asur Lomar Lonachri B'Shabbos, you can't say to the non-Jew on Shabbos, Ta'asei imi tova, do me a favor, Ein day or b'cheder, there isn't enough light in the room. Kloma remez b'lashon tzivoy, meaning a hint with an expression of instruction. Because you said, do me a favor. If you just said to him, there's no light in the room, that's a hint. That's more mild. You didn't use the verbs. You didn't tell him to do anything. Yes, you did make an observation that's going to lead there. That is better. But saying, do me a favor, means you're telling him, do me a favor. That's an instruction. Therefore, you have a problem. Yeah, Rena.
Even without saying, do me a favor, you're not still making him your shaliach?
So it seems not, because making him a shaliach requires that you actually give him a mission to do, which you didn't do here.
But you know you have the intent.
You know you have the intent of giving him a mission.
Like, when you're hinting, and you're hinting correctly, you still know what your outcome is.
Yes, no, that's true. But making somebody your agent still requires that you actually make them your agent. You are getting the result you wanted, absolutely. But you did not make him an agent. Yeah, Naomi.
What we're doing now is saying, once you're locked on your outcome, this is a mission.
Well, I'm giving you things that don't help. Next, we're going to go to the things that do help. No. These are ways to mitigate Amira La'akum overall. In any situation where...
Like without these things, it's not...
These are things that avoid Amira La'akum. Meaning, if I'm in a situation where, let's say, I'm sitting in shul, in the base medrash of the shul, and the light goes out. There's a non-Jewish caretaker who's walking around in the building, and I notice him coming down the hall. And I say, wow, it's dark in here. I did not, in that case, have the normal justifications of, like, a medical situation. But I didn't do Amira La'akum either. Now, maybe a Ma'aseh Shabbos issue. That goes back to the discussion we had last time. All I've done is avoid Amira La'akum. Ma'aseh Shabbos is its own issue. Maybe there was a little light, just not enough light. The things that we talked about then. But that would be a solution for Amira La'akum. In the medical case, I'm already justified in telling the non-Jew straight. But if I have the option of using a mitigation, then I really should. That's what we're saying. Yeah.
The last verse we did, there isn't enough light in the room fall under Rambam, Mishneh Berurah's, like, obvious missing?
I think not.
Mm-hmm.
I think not, because, again, you didn't say to do anything. It's still missing the instruction component. Even saying to him to wipe his nose is, in and of itself... There's a statement of, I want you to do something.
So is there a difference between the last two sources we
did? A difference of opinion? No, not necessarily. They're just describing different cases.
Okay.
Yeah. So what does work? What is effective? So number one, hinting before Shabbos. So you're not telling him before Shabbos to do it. You're giving him a hint, and you do it before Shabbos. So here's an interesting example of that in the Shulchan Aruch, in source number 7. Mutar lomar lo achar ha-Shabbos. You could say to him after Shabbos, Lama lo asisa davar ploni b'Shabbos sha'avar. Why didn't you do X last Shabbos? The Ava pi shemavin mitoch dvarav, even though he will now understand sheretzono shiasena b'Shabbos haba, that you want him to do it the next week. You are hinting, first of all, and it's not Shabbos when you are giving the hint. So you could say to him, why didn't you turn on the light last Shabbos? And he will understand that next Shabbos you want him to turn on the light. That's the idea. Tova, and then Ariana.
You still can't say it straight out before
Shabbos? You're not supposed to say it straight out before Shabbos. That's correct. You're asking him then, do this for me on Shabbos, and then you have the shaliach problem. Yeah. So it has to be a hint before Shabbos. That's the idea. So this won't help you in the medical situation on Shabbos.
Yeah, this is not
a good idea. Yeah.
Right.
Ariana?
How does that... You're still... It's after Shabbos, and, like, you're kind of... You're still... I don't understand how it's allowed, because the next Shabbos, the non-Jew can walk in and be like, wait, just turn the light on, and, like, you can't say...
You can't anything. Say anything. Right. So you'd have to... Bless you. You have to... You know, he who lives by the hint dies by the hint. If you're going to rely on this hint, you better make it a good one. Yeah. Abby.
So for a shul that may have like non-Jews working for them, would they also instruct them in this way, or they're not allowed because they're not in a case of polishing or something?
If you have a shul that is hiring non-Jews and wants to tell them to do X, that's what you're asking?
Mm-hmm.
Like the initial instructions to them.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you would need to employ that kind of a hint. Yeah.
Even if there's no polishing books of
right, because this is a way to eliminate Amir al-Akum. You did a hint, and you did the hinting during the week. So that's why it's okay. I have known of a greater leniency that I've heard about, but I don't want to go there because it's just going to create confusion. Yeah, let me not go there. A second way to do it is to hint without instructing on Shabbos and without mentioning the malacha. You don't mention the malacha, and you don't instruct, right? This is logical based on what we've already said. It's not such a novelty. But the Shulchan Aruch mentions this. I think I had it from the Mishnah. No, it's the Mishnah Berurah. Excuse me. The Mishnah Berurah mentions it in source number 8. Kisha omer haramiza le'eno Yehudi shalo b'lashon tzivui. When you hint to a non-Jew, and you don't use instructions. Kigon sha'omer, like you say, hanere no meir yafe. You know, that candle isn't really giving a lot of light. Likros la'or hanera zeh pecham. I can't really read by this lamp. There's too much charcoal on it. So you didn't say to do anything. V'shomeya ha'enu yehudi umetakno. And the non-Jew hears and fixes it. Shari, that's permitted. De'ein ze bechlal amira. That's not called instructing, so hinting on Shabbos without mentioning the malacha. And then the third leniency is really a remarkable one. It's subject to a machlokes. Not everybody agrees. Yeah, Danielle.
I'm just confused because I feel like in source 5 you said that if you don't mention the malacha.
In source number 5 we said you can't tell him to do something. In other words, you're giving him the instruction of wipe your nose. You're giving him something which he explains to himself, oh, they want me to do this because in his dictionary, he knows what wiping his nose means. It's just a hint.
It's like you can't have coercion.
You can't, correct. It's not just explicit language. It's when you have your personal language with him also. The last one is the most interesting one. We say, amira la'akum is a problem. I can't tell a non-Jew to do X. What if I tell a non-Jew to tell a non-Jew to do X?
That's so complicated.
Is it really complicated? Sorry?
Isn't it still a mirror offering because they're still telling the non-Jews?
Yeah, but non-Jews have no prohibition against telling non-Jews to do things on Shabbos.
Right, but we still have a prohibition not to tell non-Jews.
Right, but I'm only telling him to tell somebody else. All I did... It's not a hint. I'm instructing, but I'm not telling him to do a malacha. In other words, let me give you the following case. Maybe this will clarify what I'm talking about, because I see a lot of hands. I am standing in the hospital where there is a Jewish patient. The Jewish patient has to go home. Right? That's our circumstance. The Jewish patient has to get out of the hospital on Shabbos. They are discharging the patient. It's not safe for the patient to wait. It's you know, it's Friday night in July, and Shabbos isn't going to be over for another 18 hours. They have no food. They can get an infection. It's bad for them to be sitting in the hospital on Shabbos. So I want to get them out of the hospital. So what do? I go over to the nurse, and I say to the nurse, could you please get someone to take this person home? Can you get somebody to take this person home?
They're not hinting.
So I am not hinting at all. I'm telling them straight. They are going to tell somebody else to drive. I didn't tell anybody to drive. I just said, can you find somebody, an orderly, an ambulance driver, whoever they're going to find, to take this person home? So the non-Jew is not doing anything that they're not allowed to do. They're not, you know, and I didn't tell them to do a malacha. I just told them to talk to somebody. And I didn't tell the driver to do anything either. That's the idea. It's a machlokas whether this works. But it's a very interesting leniency. Tova. Right, I still want to avoid the verb, which is why I said tell him to take the person home. I didn't say drive.
So if you avoid speaking about malacha,
I avoid speaking about malacha, and I avoid telling them to do anything. I didn't tell the driver. I told somebody else to do something that's entirely fine. I just said, can you tell somebody to drive this person home? Can you get somebody to drive this person home? Can you, whatever. Sorry?
I just said drive.
Oh, to take this person home.
How does it work?
Careful.
Number one, then?
Sorry?
How does it work with number one?
Right, so like I said when I introduced it, this one is generally not viewed. Number one is usually not viewed as the source. Kamalachalayasebahem is usually understood not to be the halachic concern. Even number two about being a shaliach is dicey because there's a whole question of what exactly it would mean for him to be your agent. It's much more about three and four, the language that you use and taking Shabbos seriously. Those are the bigger ones. Yeah, Naomi. I suppose. You didn't tell them to do it. So, yeah, if they decide that they want to do it, it wasn't your instruction. So I think, yes, then that's fine. If they choose to do it, that was their decision.
And it wouldn't consider a miralakam?
Correct.
Wouldn't you need any special need for...
No, it would not be considered a miralakam. I think that's correct. I think that's correct, yeah.
But then what about benefiting from what they do? Are you
like... So then you have the Maisa Shabbos question of benefit from what they're doing, which... again, requires the justification, like the medical situation or whatever it is, but you've mitigated it by not asking them to do it. You've made it a little less bad. Nechama.
So you are allowed to ask them to
do it? So it's a machlok, yes? If you take a look at source number 9, he quotes you a sefer called Sefer HaChayim, who wrote, as you see in there, D'bamakom hef said gadol yesh lismoch al hamikilin, that in a case of great loss, where you want to avoid great loss, then you could rely on the lenient views. Because it is a machlokes as to whether this works. That's the idea. Yeah, Lisa.
So for the hospital case, in general, it's not necessarily dangerous to stay in the hospital. And there could be food there, but they're kicking you out
Right, so I don't mean to give practical advice for the person who's stuck in the hospital because it's very situation dependent.
Right.
It really depends on how much time there is till the end of Shabbos, where you would be staying, is there a concern for catching an infection, is this person in a delicate medical situation such that they need to be home, do they have people to take care of them sitting in the lobby? Right, so the definition of great loss is not straightforward, but the first rule of defining loss for these purposes is it's subjective. It depends on the person at hand. For one person, $10 is a big deal. For another person, $1,000 is nothing. It really depends on the individual. There's more to say about it. If you go to YU Torah, I have Shiram about it from a long time ago that may be clear or may make things more confusing. I don't make any promises, but it's a very big topic. It's not an on-one-foot type of answer. Yeah. Yes.
I'm sorry, I know it says before, but if I'm selling a non-Jew to tell a non-Jew something, why can't I use the word, like, only for me? Like, I can't say driving for
it's
my...
The problem is me, yeah. The problem is with me, correct.
But you're still, either way, you're not trying to do malacha.
Right. Correct. Yeah.
Just, I'm curious, like, how, like, this all ties with AIDS, with, like, for someone who's, sickness or is older. Like, I know plenty of people that have, like, non-Jewish AIDS, and
yeah.
I'm sure they, like, they work on Shabbos. So, like, aren't you, you go over instructions with them, like, a family member will be like, oh, like, this is what you're going to do for my mother or something like that? Like, how does that...
So, it requires being careful about how you handle it. The question was, what about instructing an aide for what they're meant to do for somebody who's older, who's sick, whatever it is? So, they can end up being your shaliach. As I said, the first two considerations are less halachically accepted. So, shaliach per se may not be an issue. But it's true that you have to be careful about how you instruct, but it also depends on the level of medical need. You know, just as we said regarding children, that there are justifications for saying they're automatically a cholashem bo sakana. If you're talking about somebody who's dealing with dementia, if you're talking about somebody who's not able to feed themselves, things like that, they may find themselves at the other end of life in cholashem bo sakana territory. Okay. So I'm going to pause things here, not because class is over. I know class is not over. Pausing the recording as well, but I have a question. But I appreciate the answers, and we'll see. Okay. So let's talk about shinui. What does the word shinui mean? Change. Right. Change. Doing something in an unusual way, a different way, an abnormal way. That's what we're talking about. So the idea here, we're now off of Amir La'akum. Amir La'akum is now something you still need to remember, but not our topic. Instead, what we're talking about is how to do malacha for somebody on Shabbos, if they have a medical need, in a way that is going to be less bad. So we had Amir La'akum as your first way, telling a non-Jew. Your second way is doing it with a shinui. We know that performing malacha on Shabbos in an unusual way can reduce it to a violation of rabbinic law instead of biblical. It becomes a derabbanan instead of being a deoraisa. Examples of this from the Gemara. Take a look at source number 10, please. It's a Mishnah in Masechta Shabbos talking about transporting things through an area when there is no Eruv. Hamotzi, bein b'yamino, bein b'smolo. If a person transports items, whether with their right hand or whether with their left hand, b'sol cheko, o al ksefav. You know what? It's funny. I left in the Hebrew, but I skipped it in the English, in the translation for space reasons, but then I didn't need that. All right, it doesn't matter. The point is, if you transport something, whether with your right hand, whether you're the left hand, or on your shoulder, chayev, you're liable. Shekein masa b'nei kehas, because that's how the family of kehas carried things. What is this Mishnah talking about? Who was kehas, and when did they carry something?
Mishkan.
The Mishkan, right. We know that, sorry?
Son of Levi.
Levi had three sons, Gershon, Kehas, and Merari. So, the family of Kehas has the major role of transporting the holy items in the Mishkan, right? All of the families, Gershon, Kehas, and Merari, all have obligations surrounding the dismantling and transport of the Mishkan. Kehas, in particular, is the family that produces Moshe, Aaron, and so on, right? Kehas has four sons, Amram, Yitzhar, Hebron, and Uziel, and Amram's kids are Miriam, Aaron, and Moshe. So, in any case, the way that they transported in the Midbar, and the Gemara goes into how you know this, the Mishnah just says it, but the way that they transported in the Midbar was by carrying things right hand, left hand, did not make a difference. Kila achar yado. But if you do it like it's the back of your hand, carrying something on the back of one's hand seems a little bit difficult to do. Behind your hand, it seems like maybe you're going like this as your mechanism. But the term kil'achar yado, behind your hand, really becomes shorthand for doing it in an unusual way. We use the term kil'achar yad as a term for doing it in an unusual way. But they now give you other examples. Biraglo, you carry something using your foot. Befiv, in your mouth. Ubmarpeko, in your elbow. Beozno, in your ears. Ubisaro, with your hair. Ubhundaso, upialamata, using your money belt, and it's upside down, so the thing can fall out. Bein pundaso lachaluko, or if you carry it sandwiched between the belt and your clothing. Ubisfas chaluko, or in the hem of your clothing. Biminalo, in your shoes. Bisandalo, in your sandal. Pato, you're exempt from liability. Shelo hotzi kederach hamotzi in, because you didn't transport in the way that people normally do. Yes.
So people that work on Excel, they usually carry their phones on Shabbos, like in their pockets or like on their belts. Would they do it in a different way than they would during the week to make it like a little bit better, or like?
Right. So I believe the necessity for the phone justifies them doing it without a shinoi. Keep in mind they're inside an eruv, so they're not dealing with the biblical hotzah considerations that we're talking about here. They're dealing with muktzah as a concern. And while it's true that you can mitigate muktzah by carrying something in an unusual way, they may not be obligated to do so because muktzah itself is a derabbanan. Yeah?
Is like carrying a shinoi or doing something with a shinoi how like, people usually do it and how it is
subjective? Good. We're going to talk about that. But the answer is that it is subjective. It's based on the culture. Yeah. But we will see that in a source. One thing though that I do want to make sure to call your attention to, when it says in the first part, someone who does in a normal way is chayav, and someone who does it in an unusual way is patur, those terms are really important. Sorry? Well, it does, but not necessarily. I'm going to show you two sets of words. Chayav and patur on the one hand, and on the other hand, asur and mutar. Okay? Chayav is the worst. Chayav means you are liable. It means that if you do this wrong, if you did it intentionally, there's one penalty. If you do it accidentally, there's a different penalty. Chayav is the worst. Don't do that. Mutar is the best. It means this is entirely fine. You can do this, don't ask any questions, don't do it in an unusual way, nothing. Mutar means it's entirely fine. The term patur literally means exempt. You have left the category of guilt. But, or the category of liability, I should say. But it's still not allowed. We also use the word usur. Sometimes they get used together in the literature. Patur aval usur. In the event that something is classified as being patur or asur, it means you're not allowed to do it, but there's no liability for doing so. Nothing happens to you in Beis Din for doing so, but it's still not allowed. So when it says here, if you carry something in an unusual way that's patur, that doesn't mean it's okay. It does mean it's only a derabbanan. Not a deoraisa. Elisa.
Is patur always assumed to be patur aval asur, or only when it says it?
So by default, it's patur aval asur. There are a few cases in Shas where patur shows up and it actually means mutter. But the norm by default is patur aval asur. That's correct. Clear? So when we say carrying with a shinui is better than carrying in a normal way, carrying kila achariyat with your foot, whatever it is better. Yes, it's better, but it isn't mutter. It's just patur. Clear? That's a really important principle to be aware of. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 11, you see this very clearly. The Shulchan Aruch writes, Asur latzeis b'shabas b'ma'os o b'kesev v'zahav hatifurim b'vigdo. You wouldn't be allowed to go out on Shabbos with money, silver, or gold stitched into your clothing. Talking about the issue of transport. So you open up the hem of the clothing, you put in the stuff, and you stitch it up before Shabbos, because sewing is not a thing on Shabbos. Don't do that. But you stitch it up before Shabbos, and now you say, I'm going to walk from point A to point B, and I'll have my money with me. Don't do that. It is an unusual way to carry things. Normally, we don't carry things stitched up in the hem of our clothing. However, it's still rabbinically prohibited. Clear?
So that would make it petar balasim?
Correct. That's the idea. To go back to the shvus to shvus discussion, because I know people really enjoyed it, the shvus to shvus, the double derabanans, so you could have the following circumstance that would qualify as shvus to shvus. You're carrying in an area that is not a biblical rishus harabim. It's not an area that's biblically a public domain. It's only rabbinically that we say don't carry there. And you carry in an unusual way, so that your carrying is also derabanan. Since the prohibition against carrying there is itself rabbinic, and what you're doing is only called carrying rabbinically, that's a shvus de shvus. Clear? Did I just make things more confusing? No? We're good? Okay.
Can you be allowed to?
For the sake of a mitzvah, for the sake of someone who's in pain, you know, the heterim that we gave before. Shvus de shvus was allowed, we said in the Rambam, for the sake of tsar, to prevent great loss, or for the sake of a mitzvah. Those were the cases we permitted. Yeah?
For like ripping toilet paper?
Yeah.
That's like Kavod Abrios?
Correct.
Is that considered a mitzvah, or is it a different category?
Kavod Abrios is its own category, but it ranks also like those other categories do. Yeah. Okay. Another example where we say that that something is okay, or not okay, but less bad if you do it with a shinui, is writing. Take a look at source number 12. Gemara in Shabbos. Mishnah says, Hakosek shtei osios, bein b'yamino, bein b'smolo. If you write on Shabbos, if you write two letters, whether with your right hand or with your left hand, you're going to be liable. That's what the Mishnah says. How many lefties do we have here? Okay. Everybody else is a righty. I would have thought for the righties, it's very odd that the lefties all sat together. I don't know what to make of that. See that? You thought you caught something and then it wasn't... No, it wasn't that at all. It's just which desk is easier. Okay. Okay. All right. In any case, not the point. The righties have great difficulty writing with their left hand. Lefties have great difficulty writing with their right hand. Unless you sat there and trained yourself to become ambidextrous, it's a really hard thing to do. So why in the world am I liable if I write with my left hand? That should be an unusual way. The Gemara asks that question in 12. Bishlama ayam in lechayev, I understand you should be liable for writing with your right hand, mishum tederach siva b'kach, because that's the way you normally write. Ela asmol am I. Why am I liable, though, for writing with my left hand? Ha'ein derach ksiva bekach. That's not the way we write. Sa'am Rabbi Yirmiya ba'iter yad shanu. Rabbi Yirmiya answered, because that was talking about a lefty. It wasn't talking about a righty. Sorry?
Like, nothing against lefties, but usually halachas and general things are taught, like, in the right-handed perspective.
Yeah, and here it's not presented that way.
Yeah,
it is odd. It is a strange answer, and that's why it wasn't the Gemara's assumption. The Gemara's assumption was that you were talking to a righty. It is definitely an odd answer, and the truth is, like, I stopped short in the Gemara's discussion. There's more in the Gemara's discussion about all of this. It won't solve your problem, but it's yes, this is not a straightforward answer. Nonetheless, I bring it here in order just to highlight for you that unusual ways of doing things can reduce it from being a biblical prohibition to a rabbinic prohibition. What I want to do next time is talk about why the Torah would have permitted it. Why does it matter whether I do it in a usual way or unusual way? At the end of the day, I wrote something. So why does that actually matter? And then we have to define something people have been asking about since the beginning of the class. What qualifies as a shinui? What makes something an unusual way of doing things? So God willing, that will be next Monday.
So a left-handed person can't write.